Hello, guys. Welcome to another fun episode of whatever this is, and we're gonna have some fun now talking about the spiritual subjects, which which also are not very tied down to any physical form. And I thought for today a great subject would be awareness and attention. And John brought up the idea we could talk about telepathy too, and I realized these are very interrelated subjects, and I'm very excited to dig into what is the heart of awareness and what is the heart of attention, and why is it that telepathy is available to some people and not other people, and what is it about awareness that allows the mind to go into the minds of others, and why is it that if we have that ability, if we're essentially like a Jedi on some level, if human beings have the level of like science fiction ability to reach out and comprehend the contents of the minds of other people, what does that say about how we use our minds and why we use our minds the way we do? And I guess I could start out just asking the question of like, how do you guys view awareness to begin with? What is it that where does awareness come from?
I think it's like, when you're born, you first become self-aware, you know, it's like, that's the first big hurdle. You realize you have arms and legs and you learn how to use them, you know, and probably even in the womb, you become aware of the presence of others, sound, things like that, you know, light.
Well, how about, because awareness is that perhaps more closely connected to consciousness? Because as in consciousness is kind of like perhaps an all-pervasive field, and is awareness perhaps a byproduct of consciousness, but it's personified in like a person, like I'm John, you're Mike, you're Randall, you're Chris, type of thing, like it. That personification of the individual is that perhaps awareness?
Yeah, it's like we're putting structure onto consciousness when we have a type of awareness.
Yeah, right. It's like there's like your active sense of consciousness, right, where you're consciously aware of that. Then there's also like a passive sense of consciousness too, I think, where you're not necessarily thinking about it, but then it interrupts you and reminds you that it exists. For example, like a danger, you know, something dangerous enters your sphere of awareness. You know, there's that passive that then comes into play, you know, where normally it's kind of, it stays dormant just below the surface, doing its own thing, I think.
So, yeah, it's interesting that you started out talking about the infant and, you know, the infant, we would even have difficulty remembering what it was like being a baby. And memory is another fascinating thread to it, because it's like sometimes it's on the tip of your tongue. You know you can access something, and somehow it still remains elusive. It's like it should be available to you, even, and you very much want to have that awareness of something that you've had the awareness of. So where is the gap in allowing awareness to come back into focus? It's almost like there's just like a continuous subconscious seeking or background to awareness, and then the conscious mind, and this might be the conscious as being separate from the subconscious mind might be a separate discussion from the abstract concept of consciousness as an all-encompassing foundation to reality, but at least the conscious mind seems to have trouble integrating the depth of potentials of perception, such that memory has to like have this physical component in our brains to help us have like ways to trace back through. I'm not sure if that's how memory even works, but I assume that there's this constant relationship between our conscious and subconscious minds in order to allow us to have some kind of a fluid of useful awareness in our lifetime.
Well, I do remember which I don't think many people have this type of memory. Some do, but I do remember being in the crib. Mm-hmm. And kind of looking at the, what's it called, the bars,
mm-hmm,
type of thing, just kind of lying down and feeling, I guess, myself, right? It currently the same whatever you want to call self or individual being or whatever, mm-hmm, and just lying there, but looking at it like retrospectively, it's kind of like, okay, the self or the awareness or the consciousness then and even now, and also when I see other people, I couldn't like define a boundary around who I am in that respect. The same way as when I look at other people, I can't really find a boundary. The boundary is, I guess, in a way, just the body and the basket of memories and thoughts that we have, that I guess you can say defining this person from another. But I also see it as a unique whole of who we are as a soul. What some people would call a soul is this perfect division from what some people like to call God, that perfect partial, well, it's really not partial either in this respect. It still feels like there's some type of infinite component to each of us in that respect. I don't know if that made any sense or anything.
On the deeper levels, it does seem like there's a, you know, the Law of One books talk about a tree of mind that were just connected like a tree, and the conscious mind is the outer branches, and then the deeper roots of the mind were so unified with God that we can hardly look there and appreciate it. It's too much for the conscious mind to take in, unless the conscious mind can silence itself to a degree and cut out all the other aspects of awareness, which certainly takes time and practice and, you know, meditative effort. What are your thoughts on that subject, Chris, the mind and the structure of mind?
Yeah, when you were talking, John, I was thinking of that, you know, on the most subtlest level, like God and our souls, right? Which are probably all one thing, right? The purest form of whatever that is. And then you sort of descend down into materiality, right? So then on the lower end of the spectrum, it's, we have a body, right? And a brain. The brain's like the computer, right? And of course, the heart is the connection to divinity. But it's almost like the power at the higher level, the divine level, the consciousness level, or awareness or power, whatever that is, some of it trickles down, some of it can sort of shine through to the physical level. And we have experiences of, you know, higher things. But in a way, it can, only so much of that stuff can come through this machine. Like, it's just, it's like, because it can't, it's so different in nature that only some of it can come through. Although, like you said, Mike, with meditation and stuff, like, we can definitely learn how to utilize our mind to allow more to come through, for sure. But it really is that whole, just the, I said trickle down. It's not really trickle down, but because it's more like light. It's light, there's pure light, and then some of it gets blocked, and it gets blocked, and then here we are in the physical world, and only a small portion of that light is in our consciousness. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's actually segments into what I was going to say too, is like, I think consciousness is like the broad state, which includes, like, you know, your, like your, you know, like sense of reality or like your conscious thoughts, even your subconscious would be part of your conscious. And then like your awareness is kind of like the spotlight. It's like you're where you're pinpointing your focus. It's like your awareness requires your consciousness, but you can be conscious and not aware. You know, like the NPCs, you know, like they're conscious. They're walking around, but they're not aware of like, are the branches aware of the roots or are the roots aware of the branches? You know, it's like, yeah, they're all part of the same tree, but you know, without one, the other cannot exist, you know, but one without the other, like for example, the roots establish themselves before the branches come into existence. So like the awareness would be the leaves, like, you know, soaking up the sun and, oh yeah, and feeling all the wind and rain and stuff like that. But the roots are really the consciousness of the tree, I think, you know. And I think we're kind of the same.
Yeah.
That's a great analogy. Somebody clip that and ship that, please.
T-shirt.
T-shirt. Thank you.
Yeah. I love what you said about
light, Chris. That's what I do for work.
Yeah. I feel like light is definitely like a metaphysical way of looking at focus and attention and awareness. And it's like, obviously light is a almost like a symbol when we see it in the physical world. It's like light is necessary in order to see. The darkness is not allowing us to know. The darkness is a lack of awareness, represents a lack of awareness of what's there because you can't see it. And so when you have light in your mind, you're seeing more. You have more potential for awareness. So the more light in your mind, the more you're seeing. And so I, you know, we could go into the subject of attention now. And you know, I you know, as a kid, I noticed.
Hold on, Mike. I wasn't paying attention. Can you start again? Yeah. Oh God, sorry.
Yeah. So the definition of attention is notice taken of someone or something. The regarding of someone or something is interesting or important. And it's interesting that there's so much that goes on inside of us that we just disregard, and we have to pick something to put our attention on. It's almost like we have, I think that, you know, working memory of a mind is shown to have a brain and a body. It seems to have a certain number of things, like 11 things that the working memory can be focused on, but it still feels like that's secondary to the singular choice that's being made in every moment to put our attention somewhere. And I was going to share the story. When I was a kid, I know that I had intuitive insights and I would receive information that to me felt like imagination. And my conscious mind said, that's worthless. I don't know why I know that. That doesn't make any sense that I would know that. So I'm just going to ignore it. And I stuffed things down. And I remembered this when I was much older in my 20s. And I learned about the value of intuitive insight being somewhat telepathic in nature or precognitive in nature. And then I actually intentionally developed that. It had to be something that I put my attention on those things with discipline more and more to receive the information that I was being given. And it's as simple as knowing which route to take when you're driving to work or which food to buy or all these different insights where we don't know the future. We don't know what's going to happen. If you don't know the future, you might as well ask your intuition because your intuition does know the future. But if you don't believe your intuition knows the future, you won't put your attention on it and such that you continue to benefit from that kind of attention.
Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead,
Brent. Just real quick, like, you know, like the word imagination kind of, you know, people kind of use that to like bully people down, like, oh, was that your part of your, you can probably just imagine that, or, you know, and it's kind of like given a negative, you know, like a fantasy, like it's not like your imagination is a very powerful thing. You know, you shouldn't, you know, as children, we're kind of told to shelf that, you know, as if it's a childish thing, but it's a powerful tool.
But when it comes to like, say, the future, is it, I know this could be a little nuanced, but is the future like a set in stone type of thing? Or is there a component of choosing something out of it, if indeed we have free will to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is why some dreams, I was actually just recently researching this. You know, there was an organization in England where there was a famous dream of like some mining collapse where a bunch of children died, and one of the girls who died had a prophetic dream that was recorded and heavily broadcast in the news that disaster was about to occur. She saw this blackness coming over the school, and so somebody was inspired to make an organization where they were trying to predict extremely disastrous events and try to avoid them. They were never successful in avoiding them, but they were successful in predicting them, or getting some intuitive data. And I realized it seems to also my own personal experience of dreams telling future aspects of my life, that it's when I can't avoid it that it's most strongly in my consciousness, because it's almost like it was already chosen. And it's just like, I think that's why precognition is stronger when something comes closer into your future, that it's a choice that's so strongly made that you don't want to step away from that anymore. And now you're aware of it.
Well, I had an experience of 2001. This experience is knocking futs. And I had a dream, but it felt more like a vision, because dreams are a little bit more discombobulated. You can be one place or another, like things change really quick. This felt linear. And I was in a scene and I died. And then I saw myself lifting up and going to the other, or whatever you want to call it. And it freaked me out for about a week. And then I forgot about it. And then like a week later, I went to a rave, and some questionable things were in my body, and some really funky experiences happened there. Really, like, I wouldn't want anybody to go through that. Very crazy. But anyways, fast forward, I was walking, because I was in like downtown area, Toronto, and I was walking to the closest bus stop, and I was feeling very like, oh, out. And then I felt like I was gonna faint or something. And then I looked around me and I'm like, I am in my dream. I'm in it. And like, and it was winter. And if I fell and passed out or whatever, I would have, like, it wasn't in like a lot of people were. It was in between the venue and Toronto, and in here it's just like a big area of like not much foot traffic, right? So if I fell into the snow, right, and it was exactly like everything, the lighting, like the environment, everything. And then I remembered that, and then I was like, no, you're not gonna die. You're not good. Like, and then I got out of it, but then it got even worse as the night went on. But the reason why I brought it up is because it was so like, it felt so definitive. But then through, I guess, my own inner will or free choice or whatever, I was able to avert myself from getting into that, receiving that fate. For example.
That's awesome. Yeah, that totally makes sense. That I don't know if that's like a higher aspect of the self that's giving you that dream, or if it's like just you. That's just what we do when we dream, is that
or
we can go exploring.
If the future is written and these large traumatic events or powerful events make ripples, would ripples react like a stone in the, you know, on the surface of the water, in which you'd feel them all around, from the past, the future, and in between? You know, because I remember in the same year, 2001, I woke up from a nightmare, and it was like I knew about 9/11. Not specifics, but I knew that a dark event would come and it would change the world. And I ended up writing a whole one of those yellow tab or yellow notepads full. I wrote a whole page about, you know, something's coming. It's a dark event. It'll change the world forever. America, you know, all this stuff. And then 9/11 happened. And I was like, whoa, I felt something coming. You know?
Yeah, that's a very common one.
So I wonder if maybe we do have the free will to interact with these things and make choices and stuff like that. But certain parts of that free will are contained within a set parameters, like something's going to happen. You can maybe alter it a little and stuff, but something's going to happen. You know, like maybe there are, I don't know, milestones that are unchangeable, but we can alter the flavor or the specifics to a certain degree. I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of feel it's like all the most probable outcomes are known. And in a sense, set. But you have the choice to choose which outcome. Because again, if free will, like there has to be something with free will.
That's why I say free will within a box. You know, like you're in a box, you can go wherever you want within the box in whatever direction, but there's still the box of reality, you know, well, or set parameters.
No, I understand. Like, I understand the whole idea of it, but as in free will in the physical and spiritual realms, they still have some type of construct within it, obviously. But within it, there are like, I guess there could be infinite, but I think it's more in a way of probable, which one is a probable path or probable paths that you can take. Because I understand that, I don't think free will is absolute, because I can't not be here. Well, like I am unable to remove myself from the present moment. So that's one thing that I'm unable to do. Even if I disappeared right now and you guys saw me disappear, to you, it would be true that I removed myself from the present moment. But if I'm still aware and moving through whatever landscape I'm moving through, I'm still experiencing the present. Like I'm unable to remove myself from that. So like, but in other ways in the whole game of life or whatever, the painting that we're making that is called our lives, I think we have a lot, like free will is pretty much, you know, the ultimate thing that you can do in any respect to your life.
I think the question comes back to the nature of identity too, because who is the one with free will, and what part of you is wanting this experience, and what part of you might think you don't, and is there ultimately any more than one will in the universe? Is there just one giant will that has chosen this entire universe exactly as it is, and we're just imagining that we're separated from that one will, and that our will somehow apart from it?
Well, certainly our actions have an effect, right? Like, you know, the classic example is if you drink a ton of alcohol, you're going to have a headache the next morning, right? Like, you know, can you drink a ton of alcohol and then just decide, yeah, I'm not going to have a headache? No, you can't decide that, because your actions have consequences, and that then you're going to have a headache tomorrow morning. And you could, you know, there's a million analogies like that. Also, I mean, look, religions and spiritual teachers throughout history have told us what we need to do, how to be a good person, how to regulate our mind, how to have the best life, provide the best lives for our families and stuff. Like, well, if there was no chance of changing the future, then why would anyone say that that you should be a good person and you can improve your life, right? Like, so clearly, in my opinion, clearly, you know, we have free will to some extent, like you said, Randy, and also we're eating the fruits of our labor from yesterday and last week and last month and last year. So to me, it's both. And that's sort of the dance of living, I guess. Improving. I don't know. Did that make any sense?
Yeah, that's good. Well said.
Like bumper cars. Like you can get in the ring, you know, you get in the car, go wherever direction you want and smack into whoever you want. Or you can just go out to the outside and just cruise around, you know, but ultimately you chose to get on the ride, you know, and when your time's up, you got to get out, you know.
Well, also kind of like the one will is expressing through potentially like infinite wills.
Through all of us, right?
Yeah, through what, however many conscious sentient beings there are in the universe, it is, and they're all unique expressions of the one as well, because it just like a parent wants to teach their child how to be like them. So, and hopefully may even surpass them. So,
or you know, like a parent too, with that analogy, yeah. A parent sometimes learns through teaching their child too, you know, and you mature
indeed
as you're going along. I think 100%. Maybe
so too. So it's kind of like, it almost feels like being gods in training. Almost in that respect, because you have to go through like what the Law of One talks about, catalyzing events to be able to learn between light and dark and all that jazz. And then to have that oneness, but even with a unique oneness, because if everything, like there's an idea, like scientifically, they call it the block universe. Everything happens always at once. In the present, right? And everything is in that, like is happening simultaneously. So if we each have personalities, not necessarily egos, ego is just a catalyzing function of the person, right? So we have personalities. Like for example, in the Christian religion, they have three persons. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. They're three persons, but one God expressing through three persons, right? But they're all connected infinitely in that respect. But yet, if you have persons, you'd guess or at least assume that if you have a person, persons, they would have personalities. So like each being is a unique personality, just like when you look at your child or family members or whoever, they each have a unique expression of personality, but yet there's this drive towards unity, towards oneness, towards that feeling of being together.
Remembrance of the love of the Father.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so beautiful being a father. It's like everything is a lesson that, you know, every where is the decision to have an experience coming from? Where is the desire for play coming from? Why some kind of play and not another kind of play? And why do I feel that he needs to play differently? Why do I feel that he needs to be disciplined in a particular way? And it's just like an ongoing dance. It's just the ongoing harmonization of wills that are pretending that there are things that are valuable besides love. And besides light, and the play immediately leads to, well, let's find a catalyst that's stronger. Let's find the enemy in this story or the darkness. Let's pretend for a while, and that pretending is always, it's like synchronistically mirroring other things going on in my life when I see my child doing it, and I just stop for a minute and appreciate that's me always. That's always me. That he's reflecting me as a 3-year old. It's really surprising.
And by using that pretend or your imagination and all those, you know, abstracty kind of aspects of yourself, I think that gives you a broader sense of understanding others when they're in those moments. Like, you know, like if you're pretending to be the murderer and chasing the cop or whatever, you know, cops and robbers, you put yourself in a safe place to be that robber, to be that bad person. And then later in life, when you see someone who is that negative thing or whatever, you might have more of a way to understand that, where that person's coming from, to the point where you might even be able to predict, you know, little things about where that person's going or where they might go next. Or, you know, I think that's kind of like intuition, in that, you know, when you are able to intuitively predict something about someone else, oftentimes I think it's your eyes catching something that you recognize that you've experienced, and you know how you might react. Therefore you can predict how others might react. This like self-introspection as a child, I think, really blossoms that ability to like catch those little things. And that gives you a broader sense of, and then each time you think you predict something and then you see it happen, it's confirming or denying what you thought might happen. Therefore you can, you know, tailor your expectations for others. And so you see yourself in other people, especially like people that you care about that you've observed all your life. Like, I used to, you know, be able to walk in after school and I could tell when my mom and dad had an argument or something was bothering them. You could just kind of smell it in the air, and that, you know, maybe the, hey, how was your day, is a little bit different. So, you know, something's going on, something don't feel right. And you notice that tiny little deviation, and that gives you a vibe, you know, and you're feeding on all those little micro, you know, little micro transactions between other you and other people, or other people, you know, conversing with themselves, or, you know, you notice those little patterns and stuff. I think you'd start developing that as a baby.
Yeah, that's like all the attachments. Go ahead, Chris.
No, that's interesting, Randy, what you were saying, because it reminded me of attention and habits. So how do habits relate to attention? What do you guys think about that?
I've worked at a holistic addiction recovery center for like a total of 3 years. So habits have a lot to do with the addiction process. So like, you can get addicted to alcohol, opioids,
cigarettes,
and, you know, less more like, say, with, say, something like weed, that could be more of like trying to repress something because you want to feel better with that, but in a way of like physically harm you, not as bad. But you can like not be addicted to any substance, and you're, for example, say you're predominantly angry, your body is releasing these things called neural peptides, which are basically little drugs that your body releases through the hypothalamus. You get addicted to the anger drugs.
And you need more and more and more.
Because you're getting used to it. Your body is getting used to that. So with anything, you can get addicted. And you can see like a before and after picture of like a heroin before doing heroin and a heroin after doing heroin. They've aged, for example. They look really scruffy at like 40, for example, right? But you can also see an angry person before they were angry and after. Similar results, because those peptides, those drugs, take over the cells because it needs more of that drug. So the emotions actually you can get addicted to your emotions, literally.
Yeah, so like your habits are like, it's worked for you before, so let's keep going after that. I liked that. Let me keep doing it. You're always constantly chasing that, like you said, peptide, or chasing that dragon, like they say, or whatever. But you're on a constant search to find it again, as if it's for the first time. But what was your original question? Was habits, how do habits relate to what?
Attention.
Yeah, it's like you're craving it, you mean? Like, if I did this, I got this result. Like when you're a baby, right? Like I cried this way. Oh, then my mom came in.
I don't know. I guess part of that, the other thing was like maybe just like people staring at their phones, right? That's an obvious example. People getting addicted to their phones. They're just, all their attention goes right to their phone. Mm-hmm. And I was also more curious about like how to change that. Like, let's say I want to change the way I give my attention.
I'll give an interesting example that may be unexpected, but I think amplifying it is actually the answer, because one of the things that I really like the idea of what we're talking about with chasing, but if I think it's like shadows we're chasing. We're looking for the light in all these different forms, even addiction to sugar. When we have an extreme addiction to sugar, it's almost like we're seeking to be fed, and feeding ourselves is not the issue. The issue is the balance and the distraction component of it, where we're, I even find if I'm snacking during the day, I'm getting less work done if I'm spending my focus on the food. And so fasting is ultimately what I need to do to balance it, but also being full will balance my sugar cravings for a time. But if it's an ongoing habit, then trying the opposite of it is what brings the balancing in. So I feel like finding the extremes and the experiences allows us to have more light. And it's a shadow when we feel like there's something there, but we're just not quite getting it yet. And it's a constant remembrance that there's something more that we're seeking. We just haven't found the light yet. We haven't pursued the light directly to, and one of the phrases the Law of One uses is we're distilling. We're seeking to have the experiences of love and light, to distill the wisdoms from that. And once we've distilled what that experience has for us, and we have the wisdom more integrated into our reality, then we make different choices from that point on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That 100% works.
When you're full, and particularly full, like from eating, right, there's a sense of this is right. But then I think even that is like being physically full is like, it's not what we're really looking for. I think spiritual fulfillment is better. Like Jesus feeding the whole room of people off of, you know, a couple fish or whatever. It's like when you're having a great conversation, even if you're physically hungry, you're not thinking about your physical hunger because you're being filled, you're being nourished spiritually versus like physically. And I think ultimately your cells, you're even in the tiniest fragments of atoms or strings or whatever we're made of, I think whatever keeps them healthy is light, is like spiritual fulfillment, love, stuff like that. But if you're not getting that, then you start to deteriorate. And if you start to deteriorate, you feel hungry. You know, you look for other ways to fulfill that, to get that feeling of being full. You know, like the, like you said, like fasting. It's like then you're kind of, you're forcing your cells to seek out spiritual fulfillment versus someone who's glutton. They probably don't have much spiritual fulfillment. Therefore, they keep nourishing with sweets and sugars and those things where they can get that, you know, that habit satiated. But in reality, that's like a drug, like anything else. It's not really what you're craving on a spiritual cellular level, right? Your soul wants to be fulfilled with family or love or deep connection, great conversation, spiritual enlightenment, all these things. But at a certain base level, you're just feeling it the primal way and with food and stuff like that, I think.
Yeah. I also feel like I'm a little bit ashamed that I can't be as joyful about ice cream as my son is. Like the amount of happiness he can receive from sugar is so harder, much Mike. Greater.
Well, which one
joy
other
is
thing,
the answer. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, one other thing that I found out works spectacular as well is just change your environment. Go somewhere where you're not familiar with. A lot of people like to go nature, for example, right? Or even go on like maybe a trip somewhere for like maybe 3 or 4 days, a week or two. You go to somewhere where there isn't that familiarity. And then when you're in that state, a lot of your stuff comes up in a different environment, and you're able to kind of like observe the thought processes or the habits or the addictions. You're able to kind of observe it through a different lens. Because here, I'm used to my place right now. It's the same. I go to work the same place. I go to church the same place. I like church because it's a great community. Like, that's very important. But there needs to be a change of environment to be able to like really maybe to enjoy your new experience. But at the same time, when you're in that rest mode, you're able to kind of like see your things, your stuff, your traumas, or whatever you want to call them, come up to be able to give them space to express themselves in an energetic sense, you know?
Yeah. I think it's elevating it out of the subconscious mind a little bit when you're looking from a different perspective, because the familiarity leads to a lack of awareness and attention on the things which are just always happening in your life.
Do you think that's why people cheat in relationships? Because they get
partially
kind of like droned out with the same old, and they're looking for a new environment, a new exciting place, I think that is one way to do it, right? But there are other ways too. Like, you can hype yourself up to like be home, you know, like even if it's just like on the weekend or when you get home from work or something, like you can drive your car home and get out and just do your thing. But like, you can take 30 seconds and try to get pumped for it, you know, and try to like, do you ever hear that thing where it's like fake laugh? You can fake laugh until you actually start laughing. I think you can kind of like do that for yourself, because there was a point where, I mean, I still do it. I love just being home, you know, and like when I start to get bored or think about it, I'm like, no, just think about what it's like without that thing. You know, remember a time where you couldn't pay the bills, or when you didn't have a partner and a family, or, you know, stuff like that. Go take yourself internally to that negative place so that you can appreciate the dismal normal that you have, you know, and get pumped about it, because you're healthy, you know, you're in a good place, you're all these things. It's like, you don't really appreciate not having a cold except for when you actually have a cold. You're like, oh man, mm-hmm. I took all that for granted, you know. It's like,
well, basically you're saying
yourself, you know.
Basically you're saying gratitude is the attitude, more or less. No? Right?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But you can like, you know, push too far, you know. But do you need to go to that new foreign place, or do you need to like meet that new person, or, you know, or is it a shortcut, you know?
I look at them all as just opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I've been many places, so to me, even going places almost has like a familiarity to it, kind of like when you go home. So there is that aspect. But I haven't traveled like insane amounts, but I've been to enough where that could happen. So there has to be some kind of like inner exploration of the landscape within you, the environment mm-hmm. within you, mm-hmm. as well as the one outside. And they could be interchangeable. Yeah.
Traveled quite a bit, and it's kind of lost its, like, it's like, oh, go on a trip, I guess. Yeah. It's like, it's fun, but sometimes when I'm on the trip and I'm there in the place, it's like kind of just, I'd be just as happy just being home, sitting in my chair, doing my normal thing too, you know?
Yeah. I've
been to India.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I've only been to Canada. That's as far out of the United States.
Yeah. So if you go to some of these other types of places, it's an experience, right? It's not just like some hotel somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you saying, Mike?
Well, it's interesting. I've had many friends who want to go hiking and go backpacking, and I find myself, you know, preferring to find places where I can just meditate. It's like this is it feels like it was always the natural logging is just back to be in the trees, and there's something about being in the trees that feels different from being in cities, and that's sort of been my primary craving for getting out and getting to a new environment. It's just getting back to something that feels like it's completely peaceful, but I feel like that's just a symbol of what I'm wanting internally. I'm just wanting to use the outer to find peace within me so that I can have the time and space to go back within. And in theory, I wish there were more like ashrams and 24/7 churches in this country or something. I know there's one church in Kansas City that was called like the 24/7 House of Prayer or something like that, the International House of Prayer. You could just go there. And I wish churches were like that, or people craving enough to be there that you could just go and meditate in a building with other people. Like that's just not part of our culture here. I'm not even sure how much that's a part of Indian culture right now. In India, if they even have places you can go 24/7, or if they close the doors, how does that work, Chris?
You can go to monasteries. Really
monasteries.
You can go to monasteries, or for the ladies, convents, right? Where it's basically 24 hours. You know, there's always some type of like quiet time, prayer time every day. I think they do liturgies like every day too. You know,
the older I get, the more I like crave quiet, peace and quiet, and like not even quiet, but like just silence from other people. You know, it's like you could be totally in a wooded area with all kinds of noises, but that's not the same as like, you know, being on a bus or in a plane, you know, even with people are all, you know, like an overnight flight and everybody's kind of sleeping. It's like being in nature. I don't know. It's like there's something there that I don't think we're really fully aware of what that is, but it's like there's like a spiritual quietness. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I hear Mike and you guys kind of saying the same thing, and in the sense that I think modern day living is so, what would you call it? Chaotic, confusing, overwhelming mentally. Like I really think the millions of little details that we have to deal with every day, it's just not how human beings have ever lived before. Well, you know what I mean? In this current line of evolution, you know, when humans were simpler and lived in nature, it was so much simpler, right? Now life has become insanely chaotic and overwhelming, and individuals have to deal with that. Like, how do you deal with that? Well, that's why, it's probably why we're seeing people kind of go crazy. And that's also why that when we go into nature, we sort of feel, well, first of all, a lot of things start being cleaned out of us once we go into nature, right? Like things just come out and like leave. But also it brings us mentally back to a simpler time. And I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I lived in the Amazonian jungle, in the Peruvian jungle, for almost 4 months. The first week was a little rough because they had no internet, and I'd have to go up the hill to get a little bit of signal on my phone, mm-hmm. right? And the humidity was rough. They're like all the animals and stuff, like it's like a chorus of like little creepy crawlies, right? And then after that week of like kind of like getting used to it,
detox.
After that, like it was like the sounds of the jungle was like a lullaby. Like when people would be there for a couple weeks and you see them at the beginning with the fluoride stare, you know, like the, you know, that type of like westernized, I live in a city thing. But then after, you just see like they have this human look. You can see the life back in their eyes. And this kind of intensity, but a gentle intensity, and going through that. And I'm telling you, it, like for me, that was beautiful, like to be able to be in that environment and to feel that connection. And it's
innate. Too, right? It's funny you say a week, because it's like most addictions I think it's right around 3 days to a week of cold turkey cutting off of whatever it is before you start to like rebalance without that thing, like cigarettes or, you know, whatever, cell phones, whatever it is. After like about a week, you're done with the addiction and then it's just the habit, right? Like cigarette smokers, like after like a couple of days, they're physically not addicted anymore. But it's all a habit. And that's the hardest part too, is like the habit of going, you know, it's like breaking that cell phone, you know, pulling it up. Mm-hmm. But then I bet you also after those 4 months, when you came back into the city life, it was probably a different kind of, you know, oh.
Well, every couple of weeks I'd go into the Iquitos, which is the Peruvian city, the Amazonian city. That is right on the Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. Very cultured and busy, but it didn't feel like a westernized city. But still, they had like basically anything you want in the city because I wanted to communicate with family and friends and stuff, right? So I'd stay there for like a day or two every couple of weeks. But so I had kind of that ability to transition. But one thing I did notice is like in Peru, like the drivers seem like they're really crazy, but I never seen an accident. When I came back to the States, first day accident I see on a road, I'm like, these guys drive like crazy there. And in the States or North America in general, they follow the rules and then boom, right? I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I think that's also a sign of a loss of intuition. It's like, I think something's usually screaming at us before we get in an accident.
Direction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that brings me back to what we were talking about earlier. A thought I had is that in terms of intuition, I think it's just so fascinating that as human beings, we have a consciousness, right, with our five senses and whatever, how many senses, right? But we also have some intuitive thing coming from we don't know where, right? And it just all comes together. I believe that when it all comes together sometimes and you have a thought or you make a decision in your mind, like it happened to me back in 2003. It was, there was an experience that we had a loss in the family and I got some intuition or things all came together. I don't know what it was, but it was like, yeah, you need to start meditation. And it was just like clear. It's not like I heard a voice. It was just like a known fact to me that, okay, I gotta start meditation. And it could have just come from nowhere, or I had already been interested in meditation for many years. I just hadn't done it. And so maybe like there's a confluence of forces, intuitive and physical, and our brains sort of figuring things out, right? Like that's something our brains do really well is take in information and then over a period of time, usually at least a day, like your brain will figure out the answer. Like without you doing anything, it's almost like your subconscious figured it out.
Yeah.
I was at a seminar once this happened. They were teaching us how to juggle. They said, oh, have you ever juggled? I said, no. I said, okay, you're going to have a partner, take the three balls. You're going to juggle for a minute. First time I tried to juggle, I literally couldn't do it. Every time I would drop the balls. Okay. And then the guy says, okay, that's the exercise. Good job. Sit down. He kept presenting for about 30 more minutes. And then he said, okay, you're going to juggle again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man. Okay. First try. I juggled like seven or eight in a row. And I was like, what is happening? And then I dropped it. Point is over that 30 minutes.
You self-corrected.
My brain was figuring out how to do it. And then when I tried it again, it figured it had already done so much work. So what I'm saying is expand that, zoom out from that. in your life or in your consciousness. Like there are times when all of a sudden your subconscious figured something out and it's like, okay, that's it. And you're like, okay, that's it.
Clicks. We did the same thing. I was just talking about this to my crew lead at work. We drive a lot of heavy equipment. And he was talking about, because he loves to teach and he loves to get people oriented on the basics of running a machine that they'd never run before. And he said, it's always the same. He'll put the guy in the, well, first he'll show him, he'll operate, and then he'll put the guy in the chair, all new, right? All the controls, you explain everything, and then walk him through slowly how to do things. And then he said, the moment, it's always the same. He said, after you've given all your verbal instructions and stuff like that, is when he walks away and the person thinks he's gone and he's watching from a distance. And he says, he'll watch him fumble. He said, and there's always a moment where all of a sudden everything just clicks, you know, and it's just like, doo, doo, doo. It could be the next day or even a week from then or whatever it is. If you haven't touched it for a while, all of a sudden you'll get in that machine and it'll just be boom. And there will just be a moment where you just know, you know, it's that. I think that's so important, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that they put too much pressure on themselves off the bat, you know, but that 30 minutes on, hour off or whatever, you know, that's key. That's awesome.
Those guys are like spiritual hackers. Like they know how to hack the mind in that respect to be able to get people to do. And it's a great service at the same time as like observing, I'm guessing, through years of watching people do it. And I'm sure they went through it themselves as well.
Yeah, like as we all do it as babies, right? We all see our parents walking on 2 feet. But we're not there yet. We might try a little, and then one moment, it's just all of a sudden, oh, I got it. And you get that coordination that your brain just forms a path, you know, and once the path reaches its destination, click.
Yeah, I certainly have to wonder if that's related to what Rupert Sheldrake calls the morphic resonance, the morphogenetic fields, that maybe it's because other people have done it, that once you're just enough intuitive to connect into, maybe telepathically connect into the vibration of that being done, then it's like you're just another finger on the hand that already knows how to do it. And maybe that's the Akashic records too, the Akashic mind, you could call it, that we're tapped into. And maybe there's just that natural intuitive impulse that we just haven't learned how to work into our conscious mind in that one particular way. And once we feel it, once you got the feeling, then you have that telepathic connection.
It's like when John said very early in this conversation about he has something that not many people have, is the memory of being a baby in the crib, right? And I agree. I know exactly what you're talking about, but I think you're phrasing it slightly incorrectly. We all have that memory. We just don't have the URL to get to it. You know Indeed. What I mean?
Yes.
So
yes,
these skills... Yes, yes. These skills exist. It's just, you know, and you might have the desire to do it, but you don't have that pathway to get to that thing. Even if there's the end point that will come into your future somewhere, and you're today, you have the drive. If you push through that path hard enough, then you'll have that URL, that web address, or you know, whatever it is, but to connect you to that thing.
What if you have, without any training, a URL to Chinese? Boom.
Well, you Chinese can speak exists right now, right? It yeah. exists. Chinese exists. You, if you have a drive to learn it, all you lack is the connection to that knowledge.
But I'm not saying just to
exactly what you're missing,
learn it.
URL. Well, I think a more challenging thing would be, do you have the URL to a language that's never been spoken on Earth? Like, where is that path? It doesn't exist here. So you'd really have to push beyond, you know what I mean? Chinese is it's already there.
But how I'm saying, like,
you've never seen. How do you contact a race that you've never had any contact with? You know what I mean? That's hard.
No, I'm saying, as in, for example, they call them accidental savants. Mm-hmm. Like a dude was on top of his roof doing some kind of like work. He falls, he hits his head, only speaks English.
In this
he's
life.
In a coma. That's the missing thing, though.
Yeah, has that soul ever been Chinese? If that soul has been a Chinese person, then the URL is all it's lacking.
Well, let Jeff finish the story, though.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
That's okay. I forgive you. So, what's it called? So the guy hits his head. He goes to the hospital. He's in a coma for 3 or 4 days. He gets up and he's speaking perfect Mandarin. Perfect. As in like he was born there. He couldn't speak English for 2 or 3 days. And then he got his English back, but he retained the Mandarin, right? He didn't learn anything or whatever. So either it's kind of like, or maybe a combination, either it's in like the morphic field and you download it like the Matrix in a movie, I know Kung Fu type of thing, right? That type of download. Or another possibility is, I've heard many languages, watched many subtitled movies. I've lived in a very multicultural environment since I was young. So all that information is in my consciousness. So if something gets jogged in a certain way, my consciousness or my brain or whatever would be able to reorganize and be able to speak that language perfectly. But the one thing that I do feel is probably very likely is you would be able to access that information kind of like a download. Like, for example, when I mentioned in as the suggestion in the email was these kids, these autistic kids that are non-speakers, non-verbal, they do have that ability. Their parents don't even know that they know 3 or 4 language. It's because they were able to download this information and then express it to others.
Yeah, it's like there's some kind of processing mechanism in the intuition or the subconscious mind. And once it's integrated enough with the conscious mind, it's like you can just continuously draw the information without having any difficulty in accessing it. But it gets such a weird... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add, I don't know if it's... This might be a very dumb question. Should we be trying to dig in our subconscious for this whatever information we want or these URLs, as you're saying it, Randy?
It depends what it is, I guess.
Well, I think a different take may be that reincarnation is real, that your soul does after this experience of being John or Chris or Mike or Randy, is that chapter closes and a veil is put over it. It's put on the bookshelf, whatever. And then it rebirths itself in a new experience. And all those previous URLs are, although they're still there, there's no way to access them. So something like a traumatic bump to the head could reorganize something and reestablish something, not necessarily in the physiology of the brain, but it could reconnect the brain to something in the soul. You know, like I was going to say earlier, is like the all of a sudden taking a hit to the head and then you speak fluent, you know, Chinese or something. It might be that the soul had an experience of a life before this life, where, you know, it's all compartmentalized in a little bubble and the veil is over it of what it was like to be a Chinese woman. And now you're an American man, and this traumatic bump or whatever physically shook something up and connected something or regrew a tendril of whatever it is that makes us, you know, conscious, reconnecting into that old self somehow. You know, I don't know if that could be it, or it could be like, you know, and I know Kung Fu. You just tap into that Akashic record kind of thing. But one of those two things is really all I can imagine. I can't imagine any other explanation for that other than like quantum entanglement, maybe, of like your cells could entangle with someone who is alive, who does have those abilities, and they're transferred through some kind of osmosis or something. I don't know.
So let's talk about telepathy. I mean, I feel like telepathy is a perfect clear example of a direction that our society is moving in appreciation of this phenomenon. And why would telepathy be a good thing, and why would it not be a good thing and helping us help each other? And, you know, what the Law of One book say is that we actually, there seems to have been a deliberate choice early in the development of the consciousness in physical form in the galaxy, that instead of using strictly telepathy, there would be hands and there'd be vocal cords that would encourage us to communicate with words, because simply having a constant awareness of what's in everyone else's head doesn't allow us to learn our lessons at the same rate. But now, if we're a society that's already so chaotically scattered across all kinds of ways of thinking, if we were able to come back together in this particular point in our evolution, I think this is more unique now than it was in the past. But I think if we do develop the ability to telepath with each other and understand what everyone else is thinking, and now I've also, there's two sides to this, where some people are very intuitive as children and they become overwhelmed and they become, the intuitive empath thing can cause people to become very hurt because they've been so open to the thoughts of others that have been so draining on them. And then they have to create walls, and then all the walls have to be broken down over time. But if we're at a point where we're with people who are willing to be loving and we want to work on becoming more loving and forgiving, then understanding what people are thinking reduces the number of steps it takes to love and forgiveness in communities which can work together. And if we can truly learn love and forgiveness, then increasing amounts of telepathy and increasingly removing the veils, the blocks to the awareness of the thoughts of others, I think we can continuously harmonize more and make the planet a better place much faster that way.
Can you define telepathy and maybe some of its examples of it in the world or something?
Sean, would you like to go into what the telepathy tape says? I haven't followed that, but I could speak from my experience.
Well, okay. So telepathy is not just necessarily reading one's thoughts, right? You can get clear language in some cases. But for example, one of my friends, I just talked to her a couple of weeks ago. She works with autistic kids. And she knows at school, right? At a school or whatever. And she knows this one autistic kid loves this Play-Doh, right? And then she takes the Play-Doh because she doesn't want him to be distracted. There's a wall with a whole bunch of drawers. She puts it in one of those drawers and she's like, he's not going to find it, right? When she sees him, he immediately, without like investigating, opens that drawer and gets his favorite putty, right? So they can see through your eyes, for example, right? And another thing too is that these telepathic autistic kids say that if a person is not open, there's a block. They can't really communicate with that person that's not open to the telepathic thing. For example, more mothers are like, what's it called? They can have this telepathic communication with their autistic kids. But a lot of the times their fathers, which sometimes tend to be a little bit more like, okay, fact-oriented or whatever, they don't have that communication until their father opens up and says, okay, I see the evidence now. Okay, I want to communicate with my kid, because I thought my kid was just this non-functioning individual. But now that they are able to communicate through something called spelling, right, using a board with letters on it, they're able to, they find out their kids are freaking geniuses, like literally like geniuses, right? And they all like to all these autistic kids like to go to a place called the Chat on the Hill. It's like their own chat room that they go to etherically, and they talk about stuff there and they figure things out. They even found some cures for themselves because of their autistic condition to figure out how to help themselves get cured. And some of those kids, like I was saying earlier about the, we were talking about the languages. One of these autistic kids, I think she can speak 3 or 4 languages. And the thing is these autistic kids are in different places in the world. Their parents don't even know these two autistic kids know each other until they say, hey, once they're able to spell, then they say, oh, I have a friend named here, this and that. They're in this state or in that country. And then they're like, is this, they contact them. They're like, what's going on? Right. So that's some of the examples from what I heard of, within the telepathy tapes.
I want to share one more example that I just found out about right before this call. It reminds me of somewhat of, when Ram Dass met his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and Neem Karoli Baba gave just this full download of what he was thinking about and his past that he shouldn't have known about. And Ram Dass felt that because he knows what I'm thinking, I feel forgiven that he still loves me in spite of knowing what I'm thinking. And I read this example. Katie Asher has a 17-year-old son named Houston. At a time when he was 17, she said that caring for him was torture. He would smear feces. He bit his hand so hard that she could hear him grinding the bone. He grunted and tantrumed all night long. No one in the family could sleep. And eventually they started using this method, what you call spelling. He'd use a pencil to point to letters on the board to make words he wanted to say. And so right around the time he was about to turn 22, he spelled, I'm special. And she said, of course you are. And then he spelled, I can hear thoughts. And then she was petrified, this article I found on thecut.com. And she freaked out about the idea that he was knowing all these negative thoughts she was having. And then shortly after that, he spelled, I am the herald of Christ. And it's like, where are we going with this? It's like, when you have these abilities, it's like, does the integration with the soul more obvious and automatic? Do you become messengers for a spiritual truth when you have the deeper aspects, deeper connections to the mind, and you know that love is the answer?
I think it's like when a person loses an arm or a leg, they develop, strength in other places. Like when a deer takes an injury to, let's just say, its rear right leg, the following spring, its left antler will be deformed because the body pulls from the left to heal the right. And I think it's like when we're born, it's almost like character creation where, you're organized in a way where all your talent points or all your ability points or your karma points or whatever it is when you're in the womb are developed, and you spend them all in one area, your other areas are weaker. And these people who are born with autism or whatever we're calling it have strengths in other areas, right? And it's like they're weak in certain areas that we would deem normal, but we're finding that, oh, well, they're super strong in these other, it's like telepathic ways and stuff. It's like, to me, it kind of makes sense. It's like nature has a way of doing that, and what we have is limited in a certain way. And we're trying to force these powers and trying to find this way to this thing. And that these people are just born and they're there, but then they don't have the ability to like cook a meal or drive a car or anything like that. And it's like, we're all just as valuable as one another.
Has anybody here ever gotten like telepathic pings?
Yeah.
From people that and coworkers, and you think of somebody, they might be calling you, or they call you right away or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. So everybody's had that on some level. And because like what you were saying, Randy, was that because they don't have access to their body like we do, that those other senses become much more amplified. And they collectively decided to come out basically this year to be able to say that this is kind of like the next level of human, I guess, evolution, is to open up the telepathic gateways, so to speak. And there's positives and negatives, but I would say in the end, it would be very positive, because imagine everybody knows everybody's secrets. And the shame that I might feel when somebody knows my shit, but concurrently the shame that they feel that I know their shit. Like the deepest, darkest, craziest stuff that we all kind of potentially think about, right? Or have done things that we're not proud of or whatever, right? To feel that, then we collectively get humbled, and then we can collectively move on. Like, as I was saying earlier, as single personalities unifying in one type of consciousness, right? To be able to move forward, right? So it does, it feels very much like that. And especially with all the stuff that's going on in the world collectively as well, like potential wars, and then all of a sudden there, it seems like a lot of them are stopping, and there's some weird statements from political figures about like we can bend space and time in an official White House statement, like things of that nature. You're like, maybe things are moving in a direction where there is an awakening, not just from ideological things, but also spiritual things, etheric things, right?
Yeah, it's being pushed into birth. Yeah.
Yeah.
All these things are coming together.
We're taking a worldwide laxative, I guess.
It's like we're not in Kansas anymore, but were we ever? You know, was it all just an illusion? You know, it's like, we're in a bubble. That's the best way I could say, is like, we're in a bubble. The bubble's collapsing. And it's like,
all right. This has been an awesome conversation. I'm not sure if we should end now or have any closing thoughts. Do you guys have anything you wanted to throw into this?
Let's try to read each other's minds right now. Okay. What am I thinking?
Cappuccino. Oh my God.
Like, that's amazing.
No, you know what? I was just thinking of saying that same thing, that we should try to read each other's minds right now.
I was thinking cappuccino.
Exactly.
Ah, Lord. Well, one thing that one final thought, I'm guessing, at least from my perspective, is what these autistic telepathic kids say, that above all, it's all about love, like the love, right? And a lot of them are like, they kind of speak in a almost biblical fashion, right? And which reminds me of one, a Pharisee asked Jesus on the road, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, love God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. That those two statements are together. So it's basically the greatest commandment is love, you know?
one of the hardest things to do.
Or the easiest, too.
With light.
And the funnest.
Yeah. 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 All right. I love all you guys.
Thank you, guys. Under this meat suit, I'm shining for all of you, including all of you watching. So this has been great. Thank you, guys.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Until next time.